Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
On behalf of NACSW, I'd love to welcome you all today to our audio conference webinar entitled, When Helping Hurts, Key Issues and Ideas for Poverty Alleviation. Today's session will be presented by Steve Corbett, Assistant Professor of Community Development at Covenant College. Steve also serves as a Community Development Specialist at Chalmers Center there.
Great. Before I get started, I'd just like to pray, if that's okay.
Great.
Father, I just thank you for this time. I thank you for just who's here and your purposes for this. Guide the things I say, guide what we hear, and just guide our conversation. Ultimately, not that we're have more information in our brains, but rather that we're just better equipped to be used by you to help people that are hurting, and especially people that are hurting socially and economically in this world, and that they may somehow just receive your love and know your love in deeper ways through things we talk about and understand and try to put into practice. We ask this for your glory and our good. Amen. Well, hello all, and so I am just going to go through some basics of the book when helping. So I have no idea how many of you guys have already read it or heard about it. If you've read it, then this is kind of just some basics of it, but hopefully some comments around it may be helpful, and maybe that'll be places if you've read it and you've had questions that you've been mulling over for a while that we'll have a chance to dialogue around those. It's easy for me to really sidetrack and spend forever on things because I love this material. I want to say this, though, before I get started, as encouragement. I mean, a lot of people have read the book and thought, wow, this is, you know, helpful information, but this book is certainly not original ideas of Brian and mine. You guys who've been in the trenches for a long time know these ideas have been around for decades and decades. I started this work in 1983, and through the early 80s and into the 90s, so much of what's in the book or things that were being talked about and discussed and tried to be practiced. And so the good news is this is not like the latest, greatest, newest paradigm to think about things. I don't like that language. I get nervous when the next silver bullet's, you know, offered as the solution to everything, because seldom is it that simple. Well, it's never that simple. So these are just our attempt to try to take some kind of the best practices and thoughts of folks and put it into fairly, you know, simple terms. We had our audience was kind of the average person in the pew who kind of cares about the poor, and they do too, and maybe just speak into that context. So anyhow, that's just a little bit of background of the book. So I'm just kind of work through it a little bit. So, and by the way, we found out, Rick and I, that when we kind of practiced this last week, all the animation's been removed. Something the meeting does when you use their free services. So I can't kind of go point by point as far as visually, but I'll try to work through this, but you'll see kind of all the information on a slide all at once. So we all know that when you ask somebody to describe poverty, you're going to hear it's a lack of food, it's a lack of good housing, it's a lack of jobs, it's a lack of income. It's always about lack. And of course, that's really true. It is part, it is a piece of it. It's just not the whole puzzle. And the trouble is if you think that primarily the problem of poverty is materialistic, it's about things, and then poverty alleviation becomes really simple. You just provide things and we're done. But that doesn't work. Providing some, you know, new seeds in the Green Revolution didn't solve poverty because things are much, much deeper. So, and like, you know, we get that pretty easily. So before you start reading all this, I want you to pause for a second because I'm going to talk about something that's not on this slide, but kind of a precursor to that. I first heard the idea, and it's in the, you know, in the book, this whole idea of relational view of poverty. Some of you guys who've read Bryant Myers' Walking with the Poor, which I highly recommend. It's a much deeper pass at these issues than what Brian and I did. But he talked about this kind of relational idea of poverty and broken relationships. I first learned that from a guy named Daryl Miller, who trained me in Food for the Hungry before we went out in 83. And he learned it from Francis Schaeffer. The Arrow had lived in Le Brie and kind of was discipled by Francis Schaeffer in the 70s. And this is something that Francis talked about, this idea that God is a relational being. We get that from the Trinity, you know, three in one, always live in relationship with each other, always will. And that as he created mankind, humanity, created in us this deep desire to be relational, and then maybe we can ask the question, are there some basic relationships that God created for mankind or humanity to live in? And one was relationship with God, the idea that we're to be known by God and to be able to know God fully. The idea of being in right relationship with self, that we should know who we are. Obviously, if you're a Christian framework, we're image bearers and we're children of God and created to glorify Him and enjoy Him forever, the old Westminster Confession of Faith. We're supposed to be in right relationship with others. I often think of Philippians chapter 2. Talks about, you know, if we've tasted of the Holy Spirit, to consider one another's interests more important than our own. I mean, it's all about being other-centered is how we should work in relationship with people. And then finally, we're supposed to live in right relationship with creation, which the term usually to capture that is stewardship, which has both the idea of the tending, the caring, the preserving, you know, thinking about how do we have, you know, still have clean water in generations to come and, you know, have a world that's still functional for future generations and to live maybe a little bit more in harmony with just the physical creation, but also to create bounty. The idea that we have this creation mandate to take what was possible in the Garden of Eden. Our Garden of Eden was never meant to be the end. It just was full of possibilities. And as we work at understanding and discovering how creation works, we can create things over time. Again, it's supposed to be for God's glory and man's good, but that's another aspect of stewarding. It's taking possibilities and making them into real things. So the idea of those kind of four relationships, and of course, the fall broke all of them, as it broke the relationship with God. We worship false gods, sometimes that being ourselves. We look at ourselves and we either overestimate who we are, or we struggle with underestimating who we are. We struggle with having appropriate kind of self-views. We certainly struggle with others rather than seeing them as more important than ourselves, and our focus should be to serve and to die to self. We think just a lot about ourselves. And then finally, we look at creation and we either worship it rather than the creator. We worship the creation, or we just abuse it and we use it for our own good purposes, regardless of its implications for others down the road, and just the idea of living in harmony with it. So that whole framework of broken relationships is which the book talks about and kind of lays out. Know that just like everything else in the book, that's not a new thought. That's how I've been able to trace back the way I've heard it and taught it was kind of through the Schaefer to Miller to me. And then Bryant just did a great job of capturing that in a fuller writing piece in his book, Walking with the Poor. And so the thinking there is obviously Christ came to redeem all those things. And so now parting of the now but not yet is to help restoration of all those different broken relationships. And that's what it means to relieve poverty. You know, as I've taught that, I deeply embrace it. I deeply believe in that. I found that really helpful for me. I've even done program design around thinking about how is this program helping people that, you know, experience reconciliation and redemption in their life, relationship with God and with themselves and with others and with creation. I've actually done program design with objectives around those and found that, you know, a fun exercise. But a couple of things that come out of that I think are so crucial to working with people that are experiencing, you know, social economic poverty, is these three terms that are on the slide, the idea of poverty of condition, being, and purpose. So, again, we look at poverty of condition, that the things out in their physical world that aren't working right. And we want to fix that, and that's right. We should want to fix that, and those are real and deep and things that shouldn't be. But this idea of how we see ourselves, and this goes back to studies of the voices of the poor that's gone around the world and asked people about what does it mean to be poor, and you hear a lot more about kind of that broken self-image, that sense of shame, that sense of inferiority. And so that's not in every person, right? But it can be there. And so I have to be really careful that if I'm trying to help somebody in a poverty condition and I just come in and do things for them, what am I saying about their abilities? What am I saying about what I think they're capable of? It's like I'm the answer man versus you have a chance to improve your own lot in life. So that's an incredibly important piece as we go around just thinking about changing and improving the condition people are in. What are we doing to how they see themselves? And it deeply ties this idea of poverty of purpose, that our understanding is that God created humanity to primarily provide for themselves through their work. We know there's limitations to that. There's disabilities. Oftentimes there's situations you're in and structures that make that harder. But that's what we're striving for, is to allow people with their work to provide for themselves, their families, and their communities. And so that's part of our purpose. And so, again, when we walk in and we do things for people, we not only could help them feel less about themselves, maybe even, you know, reinforce their sense of inferiority and shame, we also can be robbing them of their responsibility. So I think there's all this kind of playing together, the responsibility people have to provide for themselves, as well as this kind of people self-perspective a bit. And, you know, those are all at play. So for me, keeping those in mind as I'm thinking about designing some kind of program to help improve housing, or just to help people with their money management skills to be able, you know, take care of their household better, or we're looking at helping people get further education so that they can, through their work, provide for themselves and their family. Just keeping all of these things, how I go about that is everything. Because I'm dealing with this poverty of purpose and the poverty of being in the midst of trying to improve conditions. And that's the issue. It's the poverty is just more dense and a little bit more complex than just lack of things. One of the things I remember, early 90s, I can remember just sitting and this kind of hitting me as I was working in this kind of work, and about how deeply I was broken, and that even though I was working with people that were, you know, financially in really rougher shape than I was, and so many things they didn't have and opportunities to have that I had given to me, recognizing that sense of brokenness in my own life. I have 7 kids and a wife, and we've been married 30 ever. I'm supposed to know it off the top of my head. I think it's going to be 33 this summer. And plenty of brokenness there, brokenness in how I am as a worker, as I am as a brother or sister to others in Clayston, all over the place. And so that's really helpful to be honest about that, and because otherwise this Jaya Kumar Christian, who's an Ian believer, written probably one of the most powerful books called The God of the Empty-Handed, great reading, and he talks about the God complex of the non-poor, that sometimes we can kind of step in to play God in people's lives, and how that you know, that's kind of a power dynamic over people that's really, really harmful. And so just recognizing that, that I can learn, it's hard. You know, I can remember there was a lady in our church that we were trying to help. Her solution to her problem, single mom, but her solution was, if I can just get on disability, that'll solve all my problems. We didn't really think she had real reasons to be on disability, and she had lots of opportunities to work, and et cetera, but so there's a lot of hard stuff working there, and we were trying to help her in different ways. And I can remember we went once to her trailer, a little small mobile home, and we had been ministering a lot to her daughter, who was 12 years old and in our church, and her just bringing out a plate of peanut butter cookies to give to my wife and I, and you could just the sense in her of, I have something that I can contribute to you. It's not all about you helping me. I'm a human being too. Just humbly accepting that and recognizing for what it was really important, and not just saying, you know, we're here to for how we can basically fix you. So my author is an econ guy, got his PhD from Yale. And so for Brian, if all of life can be solved by a formula and a graph or chart, so Brian put this together. But it's just trying to capture these ideas that when you have people that, when we only think it's about things and a transfer of things, but and then we have this kind of self-sense of, we know better than you do what's right for your life. And not sometimes we don't have good ideas, that's not the point. But then if we have that kind of attitude and we're working with people who feel like they're not as capable, they're inferior, and they are struggling with, you know, carrying out their responsibilities in life, everybody loses. Everybody ends up poor in that sense. And it's just it's a no-win situation. So all of that is just thinking about what is poverty and kind of come basic ideas about what poverty is. And I think, let's see, do I want to go next? Yeah. So I know, Rick, you said to stop every so often. I think I've been going about 15 minutes. So I think, I think I'll keep going a little bit longer the first time before I take a little break for questions. But if you have questions, you can write them down because I can read them as they're on the side too. And I think Rick is doing that as well. So feel free to start writing questions too. and kind of having them ready to ask. So I just want to look at three really quick ideas. Again, this is just kind of overview of some ideas in the book and some kind of key ideas to consider. And I think it's actually this first one in many ways is probably the most fundamental, and that's really understanding that looking at what this is all about, what has caused the person to be in the situation they're in. So this whole first principle is about causality. This person standing for me, what's put them in the situation they're in? And as I better understand that, I might better understand what would be appropriate responses. So that's kind of idea behind this relief and rehab and development differentiation. So it's all about causality. So relief, some kind of crisis, something that basically you cannot, it's not your fault in essence. Something has happened to you that's fundamentally beyond your abilities to control. And so man-made ones are really easy. The big typhoon comes, the hurricane comes, the earthquake comes, et cetera. But sometimes these are man-made. Sometimes a lot is my work in Africa. In the 90s in particular, we're dealing a lot with the consequences of civil wars, power struggles between groups, and the poor got caught in the middle of it all and really suffered. And they weren't participants in the conflict. They were just victims of it all. But sometimes these are very individual. It's the person who comes to our church with her kids in tow, and maybe she's got the black eye, and she's shaking a little bit, and she's come in a situation from her home where it's certainly not safe for her. I mean, she may not think it's safe for her kids, and she needs safety and shelter right then. That's a crisis. Now, we can go and say, why did she marry the guy or stay with the guy? Or we can go on and on and on about maybe how she contributed by not getting out earlier. But that's not the point. The point is right there, she's in crisis, and that woman and those kids, they need safety and they need shelter. And so you respond. And you know your response needs to be very quick. You can't wait, in this case, you can't wait 3 days to send the lady home. You've got to be ready right then with your options. If you're a local church agency, you've already got plans for that and resources to respond to that kind of situation. You know it's going to be kind of a one-time or just a very short intervention. But it is the one time where it's basically you just help the person without necessarily asking a lot from them. I won't say necessarily because this is a little more nuanced than just you have and you give it to them and they are purely a passive recipient. I mean, the fact that they came seeking help is one piece. Sometimes there's things they can do. In the case of the lady, they let the police come and investigate or not. I mean, they're not totally passive participants, but the idea that the aid is primarily coming from outside them is really an important kind of, that's what kind of relief work is. My observation, at least in the States, is that we tend to provide relief when it's not really in response to just a crisis. It's not in response to there's usually more going on and some deeper things going on that the people themselves have helped contribute to. And then when we respond with kind of a provider-receiver dynamic in that, I actually make things worse because we're robbing them of their poverty of purpose in that situation. So relief is really, really important to do and to do it really well. It's one of those things but you have to have pre-planned for. I know in my years working at Food Hungary, we had a relief team. We went around the world and made sure staff in every country that we worked in had. Disaster management training so that if anything happened, they were there and able to respond. And we made sure we had stockpiles of financial resources to be able to be put into action very quickly. We didn't have to wait for the donor community to respond. As a matter of fact, most agencies do that. So when you're responding to the request for aid, what you're doing, the first thing you're doing is restocking that fund that the agency had that they've spent before new money comes in. And then once that's replenished, as more comes in, then you use that to expand your relief to maybe larger, kind of larger capacity than you originally were thinking. But that's kind of relief, and it's very important to do. It's just, I don't think it's the major, should be the major part of our work. I know internationally there's a study done years ago by a group called the Hunger Project that estimated that about 10% of all poverty in internships around the world was caused by some kind of crisis situation that called for relief. So important to do really well. just, again, not shouldn't be the majority of our work. Okay, I gotta, before I see this next thing, I'm gonna do this one next thing, and then I'm gonna pause. Excuse me. So this is a slide I actually got from a staff member when I was working with the Chalmers Center. We were doing some piloting of savings groups internationally and just looking at them as a potential ministry tool for local churches. So these little group-based savings. So the idea is you got a group of people together, let's say 10 people, they come together, they put in their 25 cents each, and then some person walks away that first week with the pot, and then everybody comes back the next week and gives their 25 cents. And this idea that, okay, right now I have a lump sum of money that I go purchase some asset I've already, you know, pre-thought about, pre-planned for. So that's kind of the idea in that. And so when they do those kinds of things, we encourage them to have what are called the, so that's one version. Another version is you put your money in, and then out of that money, you're giving loans to people, both in the group, outside the group. So there's interest to be earned by group members. And so regards to the model, there's always this idea of having a little of an emergency fund. Let's say some person can't make their contribution 1 week or a couple weeks in a row. The group has an emergency fund to rely upon to help that person with their crisis so they can meet their savings group contributions. Anyhow, with all that background, this is an email I got from a Filipina lady. She's a pastor's wife and trained in community development, been doing it for many years, and about a group and how they saw their emergency fund and what qualified as a crisis in order to access resources from that emergency fund. So I'll let you read this. Hey, Rick, are you there?
I am, Steve.
Has everybody got access to this, or should I read this?
I would say the majority of folks are on both phone and also on the website, so able to see it on site.
Okay,
great. If not, many will have your PowerPoint, even if they're not currently online.
Got it. Okay, great.
And for anyone who doesn't have the PowerPoint slides and wants them, which includes the particular slide that Steve's referring to, just send a quick email to info@scsw.org, and we'll send you a copy of the PowerPoints right away.
Thanks, Rick. So as you read through this, you can see these guys are pretty intense. Rent, you can't pay your rent, tough. You can't pay utilities, tough. Medical bills to have a baby, well, you know that's coming. These are all things that weren't unexpected. And I just think of the deacons in my church and how often, what are they being asked to help with? Electric bills and utility bills and rent bills and things that are really actually, you know, continual expenses. I'm not saying we shouldn't respond to those. That's not the point. But, you know, these ladies, this is a Christian group in a church. By the way, you know, if you see what they're paying in 20 cents a week. These are pretty poor ladies. Just their view of what constitutes a crisis. I've always found that fascinating and interesting. And again, I think we too often, too quickly, it's out of compassion and concern, we will let things be labeled as a crisis that cause for a provider-receiver relationship, and that really isn't the deal. So I think that's something to just be cautious with. The last thing I want to do, and then I'll stop before I talk to you about development, because that's a much longer conversation. Historically, there's been the idea that you start with relief, and then if you're going to continue to work with that same community after the crisis, you move from just a pure relief work to more of a rehab work, which is getting people back on their feet. So it's getting them back into housing. It's maybe getting the markets restarted the way they were before. If they lost their crops, it's getting crops replanted as possible. You know, if they're after the tsunami in Indonesia, I was consulted and did some work, and it was part of getting small businesses back going by getting their tools and getting them tools back together. The rickshaw, there's a rickshaw co-op, basically a rickshaw guild, and it's providing grant money plus a loan to help them buy a rickshaw to get back to work. Those kinds of things. That's all called rehab. It's just getting people back on their feet. And basically, in those programs, it's the beginning where, in order to get the benefit, people have to begin to be doing things. It's not just here your need and I'm just going to hand out something to you. So there's usually some kind of exchange, and as you see here, it's some kind of a cash for work or a food for work or a commodity for work program. I know that down in Haiti after the earthquake, some of the best organizations had shifted from relief work to beginning some rehab work within about 6 to 8 days after the earthquake. not 6 to 8 months, 6 to 8 days. They were able to get, you know, people temporary shelter quickly, but realize what we got to do is get, you know, more permanent shelter going. They got people into medical clinics, got arms set, a lot of broken bones in earthquakes. And then we're starting to ask questions, how do we get businesses reopened, and et cetera, et cetera. They transitioned pretty quickly, not for everybody, but for enough people that that was the appropriate thing to do. So one thing to realize is that the idea of doing relief and rehab is basically kind of a package deal, often. Whereas development, which we're going to look at, sometimes can be the next stage, but for most of us and most people we meet, that's where we start. You don't start doing relief and rehab unless it's a response to some crisis and the, getting people back on feet after that. With that, I'm going to pause because Rick doesn't want me to go on for an hour and a half without taking a breath, which is a good move, Rick. So I don't know if you want to get how you want to do this. I'll just be shut up for a second and let people chime in or join
so,
in.
So there are two ways that you can make a comment or ask a question. And Steve's a feisty guy, so don't be bashful about mixing it up with him. He likes that. So you can either hit *6 on your phone pad, or you can type in a comment in the chat section on the lower left-hand portion of your screen. So again, *6 on your phone pad if you want to be heard audibly, or you can type in a message on the chat feature on the lower left-hand side. So now's the time. Any questions or comments? Let's hear them. Well, Steve, that's not usual to have 45 people speechless, but I guess you typically do that with audiences, so maybe not a surprise.
So basically, I bored them all to sleep, you know, and this is lunchtime, so this is not good. Or they've already know this stuff, or they're so in awe they don't know what to say. So I know it's not the last one, guys.
Maybe I can pitch a question that occurs to me.
Sure.
I'm familiar within the social work field. There's a real sensitivity to, I think it was epitomized in a book title from a number of years ago, Blaming the Victim.
Right.
As you were talking about the description of relief, it's a harder line than I think many of us have necessarily been exposed to in our training. And there's always that potential challenge of taking such a hard line that, if not blaming the victim, at least being unaware of all the dynamics that contribute to that person being in a very difficult place to do some of the kinds of things they need for, you know, even basic survival. And just wondering, you know, from your discussions, how you help people struggle with that tension, not to blame the victim,
sure,
not to be harder in a way that's insensitive, because we don't know the shoe, we haven't walked in their shoes, we don't know where they've come
right
from.
Right.
And on the
right
other hand, guarding against what I heard you saying, you know, some folks are guarding against, and that is taking away, you know, the respect people deserve to be encouraged to play, you know, a strong role in provide for themselves and their families.
Right. So actually right now I'm in the midst of trying to finish up a book called, what's the title going to be, Helping Hurting in Church Benevolence. So it's, you know, very much for the local church kind of context of people come to church and are, you know, needing help. And one of the chapters I'm writing at is this whole issue of, you know, trauma-based kind of response and trauma-based care, just recognizing that, you know, people have had things happen in their life historically or recently that is just earth-shattering. And you do a lot of things to, I mean, this is your guy's sweet spot, right? Appreciating and understanding this much, much deeper. And so, yeah, people might not process situations and opportunities like I would. From my relatively easy life. And so, yeah, just being sensitive to, because they're not responding the way you think they should, it's not just because they're lazy, it's not because they're just looking for a handout, there just might be way more at play. So one of the things I'm doing before I get into the guts of kind of how a local church can help the poor in their community is appreciating that. Also appreciating the whole idea of, you know, people that live in a crisis mentality, it almost becomes like, I'm not even sure if it becomes physical, but it certainly becomes a psychological addiction to the balls in the air. And I come alive when I got to solve the problem, and now the problem's kind of solved temporarily, and I kind of collapse, and the next thing I know, all the balls are in the air again, and you get in this up and down cycle. I'm a deep procrastinator, so I can identify with that. Wait till the last second when the pressure really's on, and then you perform, and then boom, you collapse. So I get that up and down cycle. Kind of just appreciating that in people. Yeah, so you're more empathetic than just harsh. At the same time, you present yourself as a listening ear and all that, but at the same time, you're not just saying, gee, how can I get these people's stuff? How can I access this program and this program and this program for them? When maybe accessing that wouldn't be the most helpful thing, because it might not, be part of the triggering, change that's needed in their lives. So it's a compassion space. It's an incredibly listening heart posture. Not be quick to just categorize people. But part of this is measuring, this is what we're going to get to in looking at development here, is this whole issue of people's receptivity to change and triggers for that. And that's what I'm going to talk about all next, so I won't get into that right now. But, yeah, so I definitely appreciate that. I think that's a good caution. I see that in just, some people love the book. They say, good, now I don't have to help those poor people. It's their fault. And that wasn't our intention. So, yeah, empathetic to that. But at the same time, again, our social service delivery model, I think, has lacking some things. And this is one of the places I think it struggles with. And I know, sometimes you can't do anything about it. You're under obligations. You're under programs that are demanding you do certain things that, sometimes are really helpful for people, but not always.
Thanks, Steve.
I was fortunate. Yeah, most of my work, again, was internationally, and so my work domestically is much more focused on being within the context of the church or the smaller nonprofits that are doing this. Not the mechanisms for many people who've chosen social workers' career are doing that within the context of I'm working for the government, which is great and incredibly needed, but maybe sometimes some limitations. Although, I don't know, again, that's not my area. I know that the social workers that are in our county, a number are in our church, they're doing a whole lot more with the whole, kind of group-based work, getting the family members and others gathered together around a person and a family, trying to solve things collectively, the action plan that everybody's got to contribute and those kinds of things seems to be becoming a much bigger thing that's happening here. So, again, this is not my area of expertise, the social work field, but that'd be my comment.
I would call to your attention, you probably see them as well, but several of the comments that I think indirectly connect to the question that I raised and the response that you gave. I think some supportive comments that the frame and the context that you gave helps give a good place to start.
Now I'm seeing some comments. There we go. Yeah. The equality. We often say that we're all equal before the cross, and as far as helping people know who God is, it's just one beggar showing another person where they got bread. All of that. That's real. That's real and deep. And I know when I don't embrace that, not only am I not very helpful with poor people, I'm a really lousy father, and I really. And I never allow my wife to speak. When I go to conferences, I don't let her sit in the audience because she will say, if you realize how stupid this guy was who's talking to you and how funny he is, I don't want the cat out of the bag. But, yeah, same thing. If I don't get that, it's over. And I think that that's an internal work of the Holy Spirit. But it's one that gets lost really fast when you work over and over with the poor and you just get discouraged and sometimes you feel burnt and by people or just the system but just keeping that sense of the depth of brokenness, not just of individuals, but God, we live in systems that just don't function well for everybody and certainly aren't fair to everybody. And I think that's another thing that we don't appreciate as much. I think, people in the social work field have a much better feel for this, but the average, evangelical Christian in America doesn't always appreciate as deep as we need to the reality of systems that don't work for people, that are uneven and unfair. And it's not just about the person sitting in front of you in the situation they're in. It's all that's fed into that and being a little bit more empathetic to that.
Steve, you might see one of the earlier comments was books and authors. Does one of your slides or toward the end, are you going to give sort of an outline of some?
I actually don't have that. I could probably provide that for you after the fact if you want to post it. I see that you wrote down God the Empty-Handed and when helping her. I mean, not with walking with the poor, right? That was you that wrote those out, right?
That was actually Andrea Summers.
Oh, Andrea. Thank you, Andrea. I'm sorry. I'm scrolling there really fast here. I'm trying to look at that. Yep, those are two. Maybe at the end I can talk some more and just slow down and tell you a few other ones that have been really helpful for me.
Terrific. And if you do want to send something, if you have something already put together, if you send that to me,
yeah,
I can make that available to folks who participated
in
today's session.
Okay, sure. Okay, I'm going to move on. Is that all right, Rick?
Sounds good. Any other comments or questions, folks, before we move on?
Hi, Rick. It's Lisa in Pennsylvania. We have a quick question.
Hi, Lisa. Shoot.
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm a student at Grove City College. You talked about relief versus rehabilitation versus development.
Right.
Do you have any suggestions for how to break a cycle in which, like, a system of relief is just a typical system? I grew up on the mission field, and where I grew up, it's just a system of dependency has already been so long established
right.
that you come in and you try to do more developmental work or even more rehab work, and people stick up their noses and aren't willing to take it. And it's just a cultural
right.
thing that's been established
yep.
over the years. So I wondered if you have any comments
sure.
to break that sort of cycle.
Yeah, one of my best friends is a Brit, and he always says there's no such thing as an unspoiled community. You know, every community has, and probably many people experience just the handout type approach, and that does create all those problems. I'm going to look at this a little bit later. I'm going to talk about receptive people. Every community has a mixture of people, the innovators, kind of the followers, the laggards, and then those who just won't change on certain issues. I think so part is, when I went overseas, I kind of had this false idea that we're all going to join hands and sing Kumbaya and march forward to solve poverty in, you know, poor communities in the Dominican Republic. Boy, that got shattered pretty quick. And I began to just be willing to focus on those who were receptive changing and then working with them. Again, I was in a context where I wasn't being demanded by a program to have to hand out stuff. And I was very thankful for that. There were some elements of our program that had that piece in it, but I had some freedom to try to work around that a bit. And so that's what I would do. I would start with, we know places, if you're actually running, if you're asking, like, I'm running a program, I'm part of a program that's already doing that, so where can you learn to start tweaking that a little bit? And you're going to get certain people respond to that, and those are who ones you focus your attention on, for sure. If you're going to be trying to do something new, which is good in some sense because you don't have that history. Others, they've got a history of that dependency. You just have to stick at it. It's going to take a lot longer to overcome that history, but I've seen it overcome over and over and over and over. It just is incredibly slow. Another book I like is called Water Buffalo Theology. It's written by a Japanese brother, and he talks about God being a 3-mile-an-hour God, and change is often at 3 miles an hour. And if you walk, try driving your car at 3 miles an hour. See how incredibly infuriating that is. You just want to get out and walk. So I think this part of this is, it isn't going to happen quick, but you've got to deeply believe you're doing the right thing. And I don't have time, but stories of my own, where I've been in communities that I followed in one community, it was just the worst handout program in the world from our agency, actually. It was really poorly run, and I came in to make some changes, and it worked, but it took a number of years, and I had a lot of anger of people who were really mad that I wasn't handing out anymore, and, you know, are you stealing our money, and just lots of accusations. I just had to say that's okay. I'm willing to put up with that. I'm willing to be dealt with that way for the sake of something that's better. And so I wish there was a nice, easy, magic answer. There isn't. It's going to take a long period of time, and you've got to be convinced you're doing what's right and put up with being yelled at, being accused of things, et cetera, and just keep moving forward.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
That was an excellent question. Thank you very much for posing that. Steve, I think we're ready to move on to your next section.
Okay, sure. So again, relief and rehab can be kind of a package. You can just do relief work, but if you're going to stick around and, you know, hang out with a group of people longer, you're going to get to rehab. Whoops, where are we at here? Next. Why is that there? Ah, there we go. My clicker's not quite doing what it's supposed to do. There we go. Sorry. So development, this is this one definition that comes out of the whole broken relationship thing, the idea of helping people move closer. So it's recognizing all of us are somewhere, and it's just getting closer to what God would have in our lives. So it's not like there's a certain starting point we're all on. It's just progression. And the idea that if you're going to do development, you're doing it with people, which means they are actors themselves, and you are a fellow actor with them. And so all of this work is out. Most of our work with people who are poor is, what can they be doing to contribute to improve their situation, and how can I stand with them to help that succeed with my encouragement, help them succeed by providing resources to add to their resources, efforts to add to their efforts, ideas to add to their ideas. But it's always this idea of adding to, kind of building on. But if people aren't moving, you can't walk with somebody who's sitting still. Someone's going to talk about the whole issue about receptivity in just a second. And this is the hardest thing. When you find people that are poor or in bad situations who mentally are saying, it's not my fault, I didn't contribute to it at all. And again, back to Rick's point of, you're not trying to blame the victim, but you're also helping them see maybe you have contributed. There's things you could have done that you didn't do. There's things you did that didn't help. And helping people look at what they can control versus allowing them to stay in the mentality of, no, this has all been done to me, and it's up to somebody else to fix it. We all know that people sit in that situation on any issue in their lives, change isn't going to occur. So people have to be at the middle of just kind of where I'm going to go in life, and how am I going to get there, and what do I have to start doing to be part of that, as well as being at the evaluating table. We're good at, you know, we get grants and we have reporting. We're really good about reporting up the ladder what is success and what's not. But the reality is it's the person themselves or their families, their communities, if you're working at that level, it's their right to say this worked and what worked and what didn't work. And we got to get beyond just evaluating for our own reporting needs and desires. So one of the things that's part of the whole, you know, you guys have all heard of paternalism. Some people in community development, it's called a community organization. It's called, you know, the iron rule of community organizing from Saul Alinsky. But this idea that providing resources a person can provide for themselves or something for what they can do for themselves, that definition is what I learned when I first read a book called Two Ears of Corn, which is about ag development, which probably wouldn't be appropriate for this audience, but it's my first book I ever read on development back in 1980, whatever that was, 82 or 83. And he had this, you know, provide this definition of paternalism. Over time, I added the word habitually because I said, sometimes, you know what, God just calls you to break the principles. You're in a situation and you look at this and you go, you know what, there's things they should be doing, but God's just calling me to do this. And I think that's appropriate. You never quite know how he wants to express his love. But you don't want to be doing that on a habitual basis in a pattern with a person. And you also have to be, and this is the hard part, you have to be really aware, maybe I only did it once, but what if this is a pattern of many other groups doing the same thing, this person or this family or this community? So collectively we're acting paternalistically, even if, you know, I'm only one piece in that. And that's hard to kind of own whole of contributions versus just my little silo of activities that I'm involved in and the programs I'm running. But this is all about empowering. I love Bob Lupton, and I saw earlier somebody mentioning about Toxic Charity. That's his latest book that, you know, Bob's at a place now that he doesn't have to please anybody. So, yeah, I think Toxic Charity, I've known him for a while and had him speak in my class and been to conferences with him, and he just kind of let it loose in that book, and I really find it very, very helpful to just say, God, guys, this is kind of the way it is. And he says, you know, you can't empower anybody. All you can do is create the conditions for that. Because only people can choose to move forward. And so that's kind of what empowering is. So if you've got that in your vision statement that we empower people, I would encourage you to rethink that, because you can't do that. You can't do that to somebody. They have to take the steps themselves. And when this idea of products and project is kind of my terminology of, you know, so the idea is they're sitting here and they're struggling to pay their bills. Okay, so the product or the project's going to be, let's do some money management training. Let's work on that. But in the midst of that, I'm really asking, how I look at empowerment is, am I just helping people be better equipped to look at their situation, to be able to analyze it well, to make decisions first, to do something that will improve their situation? To be able to act on those decisions. And that's the empowering process. It's all of those. And if you listen carefully to that, part of it's the person, can you analyze your situation appropriately and correctly? And that sometimes people can do that alone. Oftentimes it's in dialogue with other perspectives. I know one of the most powerful things in my life is when my kids come to me and speak into my life about how I'm not doing well as a father. What's really interesting, because I have so many of them, they're older now, so it's really getting more fun, is they're able to typically do it when they speak about how I'm not fathering well one of their siblings. That's very powerful. So that's why the collective voice in looking at a situation, analyzing it, and getting more of an accurate, possibly more accurate picture is really helpful. But then make a decision, what could be done about this? And again, this is where you don't just run in and say, well, you need to do this, 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 and this, and you got your list of three things. No, let people think into what they think could solve it, and then you can contribute to that and maybe fine-tune it and maybe add some new and fresh ideas, whatever it might be. But then ultimately they've got to act on it. And sometimes their desires to act on things they want to act on, they can't do it by themselves. They don't have the resources. They don't have the time. They don't have the expertise. And that's where these outside resources become incredibly crucial to build upon the resources they have. That's why one of the things I like about IDA programs are kind of match savings programs for the working poor. People have to learn how to save, and they save a little bit, but then you come along and you kind of really leverage their savings by matching it to buy an asset like home or start a business or go to school beyond high school, those kinds of things. Oh, by the way, I see some of your Bridges of Hope. Love you guys. Absolutely love you guys. Phil Olson, who's on your board, is a friend, and boy, do I appreciate what you're all about. As an aside, one of these days I'd like to get one of my students interning with you guys in the summertime, but that's another discussion. Sorry, I read something. I am a little scatterbrained, so sometimes I want to run around a little bit and look at some of these questions as we're going. So people need to be receptive to change. People need to be open to it. So I saw this years ago. This is nothing new, and you guys have all looked at this, but I do really think it is good to just rethink about the whole issue of receptivity and measuring that a little bit. The book I'm working on right now, this benevolence policies for local church, part of it is in their intake form, and after you've kind of had an interview with a person and heard their situation and tried to flesh it out a little bit, maybe followed up with some further conversation, at the end of it is kind of saying, are these people receptive to potentially doing some of the hard things it might take for them to really improve their situation long term versus just dealing with the situation in the immediate time frame, but getting the whole issue, right, getting to the deeper things. That's about really asking about their receptivity to change. And so this was a graph that I once saw years ago from our training manual in Bangladesh from something called the SAR project process. But, people that say there is no problem or there's a problem, but it's somebody else's fault. If you really think that, again, I totally appreciate, don't go quickly making these judgments about people. You got to listen pretty hard. Give people a chance to speak, be a listening voice, not just a little sitting there checking off your boxes on your form. But if you really see this as what's going on, there's not much you can do. And this is the place, if you go ahead and pay their bill or do the thing for them or turn them on this resource, and this is where they're at, this is where I'd say you're actually definitely not helping them and you're actually hurting them if it's not a crisis. Because you're allowing them to continue to live in a frame of reference and a mindset that is incredibly not helpful to them. And we all struggle with this. There's places in my life I don't think I'm the problem. It's somebody else. I go back, interpersonal relationships is so easy to do. But looking at that and understanding that and hearing that, no, maybe I am part of the problem is really, really important. So my counsel is, if you really, after interacting, however you do that, whatever process you have, and that's part of what you want, is a process long enough to be talking to people and listening, that you can make some tentative judgments and, you know, get very tentative, hold them with light grasp, that if they're in the situation, don't be paying their bills. Don't be relieving them out of that situation. I'm going to talk a little bit about triggers to change and why that becomes really important. Well, I got to move on here. So the second thing, yes, there's a problem, but I have my doubts, especially about what could do it. So you come along and say, boy, if you could just get your GED, this would open these doors, or if you wanted to do this IDA program, this would open these doors, whatever it might be. You're proposing, hey, if you just did some money management, you might find out that you've got you have a chance to have to pay your bills better, and even save money that you never thought possible. And so people are like, yeah, I know I've got a problem with my money, but budgeting is really going to do that? Really? You know, so you have to work with them a little bit more and sometimes get them started programming, but just be recognizing they've got these questions and being there to answer them. Sometimes people get it and they say, yeah, I know if I did this, this would be helpful, but what am I going to lose? What might be the consequences to me for making this change? My daughter works with a local agency called Room in the Inn, and they work with homeless women and their children. And my daughter's a child advocate, and she's been working for a few years now. And I think they've got an excellent program. And kind of the capstone of the program is this 9-month residential thing where they're working slowly to work on different issues of parenting and money, and if there's addiction issues and et cetera, et cetera, and, you know, moving towards getting work and consistent work so they can get to transitional housing. I mean, it's a really well put through program, but what they notice is often people get close to the end of it and they'll self-sabotage. They'll do something that gets them kicked out of the program or sends them way back, and it's like, why did they do that? And sometimes people are actually fearful that if they go through a program and it succeeds, it kind of removes an excuse from their lives. It's like, okay, I've done this, and now it's kind of up to me, and I'm not sure I'm ready for that. I'm afraid. And so really walking with people is in fears, and that's why I'm teaching a class right now on U.S. economic development methods, kind of, you know, small family-level interventions in economic development. The number one predictor of success of all these different kind of programs involving with housing and job preparedness and money management and financial literacy, IDAs, is the use of mentors. I don't even like the word mentors. I love the circles of support model. It's people that come along and are allies. Jobs for Life calls them champions. I love that terminology. From that program a few times in our church. Just stand with people, and you're there to help them with their fears, and you're just part of the voices in their life to encourage them to get through. So this is the group where most of work should be, is this category. Want to change, just there's obstacles, and this is where I don't get check does it. I think this is where voices in people's lives does it, and giving, being there and giving them really deep, deep time. I mean, I think you guys are Bridges for Hope. That's what you're really doing, is you're providing people with relationships with other people that allow them to work through their fears and work through their concerns. Then finally, you know, what we all wish we started with, and that's people that say, I've got a problem, and I want to, let's back up, and I want to fix it, and I'm ready to go, and even the last one, I've fixed it, and I want to help others. I know, again, where my daughter works, two now of the members are people, women who used to be in the program, so you can imagine how powerful they are as voices of, hey, I was there once too, and now look where I am, and I want to help you get there. This for people, this receptivity is people, we don't see this very often in our work, when people are entrenched in really deep things. Once in a while, maybe, but this is not norm and we shouldn't expect it. So my encouragement, again, just to recap, is for the first group, they don't see a problem or it's somebody else's problem that's caused and somebody else needs to solve it. Just be really careful to be throwing resources at that category. Focus on that middle one of really creating programs that allow you to have time to walk with those folks over time. and hear their stories and hear their fears and stick with them, and they'll take sometimes two steps forward and four steps back, but with them as they just go through that long process of change. As part of the book, we're doing some interviews with different churches that have done, you know, good benevolence work and their stories, and just listening to that, it all comes back to this. People start forward, they make mistakes, they go backwards, but you stick with them, you walk with them. And this one man had been in prison most of his life, was now in his late 40s, and started interacting with them with small things, moved to big things, and he's actually now a deacon in their church. After 15 years of, 10 or 15 years of walking with this man, this incredible change, step by step, but, you know, going forward, coming back, all that kind of stuff. But I just because they're in front of you and they say they've got a problem that needs to be solved, be careful about just how receptive are they to owning up to being part of the solution. Again, I don't think that's mean. I don't think that's blaming the victim. First of all, I don't think that we got to be careful about the victim. The situations that some of it they could control, some they can't. But are there things they can do to help improve their situation? And I think many times there can be that. But. And this leads to one more thing, and then I'll take some questions, and that's the idea of triggers for change. I've been kind of playing around this a little bit. Tend to be three larger categories. One, crisis happens, you know, something hits you that you didn't expect, shakes your life up. I was living in Mexico in 85 when the Mexico City earthquake hit. Houses were coming down. 27,000 people got killed, most of this in one barrio that was really poor, just off the main Zocalo. And I was sent there to do the relief work. And, boy, you know, just people's openness to maybe not want to live there or improve their housing, and just that just provided openness because of, you know, the panic ball. We know in New Orleans, people are saying New Orleans, at least in the short run, is not going to be the size of city it was before Hurricane Katrina because people left, got out. I know some people that came to Chattanooga, and they're still here because that crisis kind of got them out from where they are, and they started a new life here. Again, I don't think, you know, leaving your homes is always the answer, but for them, that was the prompt that caused them to reevaluate their situation and make huge changes. The biggest one is this middle one, and this is really touchy. I like Jay Van Groningen's. He's a little kind of a short, almost a theology of this. Jay has an organization called Communities First up in Michigan. He's with the Christian Reformed Church. Jay is the real deal, and he does a lot with community development and community organizing. But they have some excellent training material against the organizational Community First. But in that, he talks about being careful that, you know, sometimes the burdens of life are there to help us change, and sometimes we can get pushed pretty far. I'm an ex-drug addict, so I get some appreciation for this. I mean, I dropped out of college. I end up homeless in New Orleans. Wasn't a blur, and just a lot happened in my life. For me, part of it, the burdens of feeling so insignificant and so lonely. And I come from a farm family in Vermont. I got the greatest parents, incredible extended family. Nothing in my background points to me being such a goofball. But it came to a point where I was kind of just, is there anybody there for me? Which was really weird because I had a great family. And that's when I turned to the Lord. Came and grabbed me, however you want to say it. But so sometimes they're taking away the burdens. We've got a man we're working with our church, and a great guy. I love him. He's got three young boys. He loves them. He's got his wife. They struggle in their marriage. He's ex-homeless, and they've just had a lot of struggles. A lot of it is. He doesn't want to have to work 40 hours a week for a living. He wants to make his living by producing art. And he's okay, but anytime he tries that, he can't provide his family that way. And for us to come in and pay their bills while he tries to do something that over and over and over in the 20 years they've been married or 15 years they've been married has not to work, it's not helping them. The times he's gone back to work and worked steadily for a while is when we actually have made him not help pay the bills and make him realize I can't take care of my family unless I do something that at one level seems beneath me or meaningless labor or whatever it happens to be. he got a job working for Walmart, but it was when he was there, he was paying the bills, and things were, the food was on the table, and they're doing okay, and then he gets in this thing of, no, I don't want to do that, and off he goes. And if we come in at that point and support that, we're not helping that family long term. I'm trying to work with some other things with him of, you know, kind of building his capacity to do more than be an entry-level worker at Walmart, but to pay their bills actually is hurtful. And so this whole idea of releasing people's burdens prematurely, and I've seen that so much in international work, women in Guatemala who are just tired of seeing their young children die of malnutrition, and just getting to the point of saying this never again. And that's when they were ready to listen to water and sanitation messages, is when just the burden of the reality of their family life was like, no more, no more. So I don't know. That's a tough one. I don't want to overstate. Let's let people just be pounded into dust before they help them. But there is a point there, and I think the trouble is only the Lord really knows people's hearts, but recognizing that sometimes our well-meaning interventions could actually be taking people off from looking at things that they really need to start thinking about doing. And then the last trigger is just new opportunities, new ways of seeing things. That's why I love IDAs, for example. Hey, did you realize you could go back to school, and we could help with that, and for every dollar you earn, we'll match it with three. And I watched some videos and showed my kids some video, my students some video of this, you know, people who did that for housing, and they happened to all be single moms in some of the case studies I found. And just the miraculousness of, wow, if I go and earn, you know, save money, this group will very match it. I can actually own a house. It was just really wonderful to see how that new news was so striking to them. And, you know, oftentimes when we counsel other people and people counsel us, it's just they're helping us see something differently that we haven't quite considered before. And that's those are triggers. So we can be the last trigger. The second one, we need to recognize when it's an action and be careful about taking that potential trigger away. So that would be my counsel on that. I know you guys are really having fun going back and forth with all the side things. I can't talk and read at the same time. But it's Communities First, Jay Van Groningen, and he's out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I know your next conference in November is going to be up there. And I don't know if there's any way you guys connect with him. I think. Here we go. We got 8 more minutes, right, Crick? Wow.
You're right.
All right, I'll do this book fast. And I'll, okay, whoa, I knew this was going to happen, right? So all this is this idea of needs versus asset-based. I'm assuming many of you guys have heard this terminology. It's simply saying, yes, there's problems. It's not ignoring problems. There's problems in families. There's problems in communities. The question is, when you solve them, where do you start? And asset-based development says you start with people and their resources. You spend time trying to identify them, and you spend time trying to help put them into action. And then outside resources get added to build on it, which I've mentioned earlier in development. I mean, you just don't do development by starting with outside resources being the lead. You start by helping people look at what they have within them, their social networks, their time, maybe it's financial resources, their talents, whatever it might be. You start with that, and then you say, okay, what's needed to be built upon that to help overcome the obstacles in life to move forward? And that's where outside resources come in. You don't want to lead with them. You don't want to bring too many of them, and you don't want to bring too few of them. It's really discouraging when somebody tries to do something, you say you've got to stand with them, and you don't help them to the degree they need help. They really, truly need help because they're doing all they can. But it doesn't do any good if somebody wants to change something, and this idea of tokenism is when you provide, yeah, you ask them to do something or contribute something, but it's so minor, it's kind of meaningless, and you provide the vast majority when they could have actually contributed more, and that's called tokenism. And that is incredibly devastating to people's sense of well-being and their self-identity, and when they feel like you're just basically playing a game with them as far as their contributions. So that's what this is about. So I'm going to kind of skip through those slides because I kind of just covered the whole thing. But the process is identify, mobilize, and then you connect further resources as time goes on. Start with needs-based. Often the problem, again, is you just start by assuming that the resources have to come from the outside as the initial starting point, and you don't spend time asking what's there. Hey, I am done. Wow, I'll be dogged. We got 6 minutes, brother.
Great. Then let's open up for.
Oh, Love Inc. By the way, I'm sorry, on the side there, brother. Sorry to cut you off. I'm starting to look at. There's Jolene. Hey, Jolene. Yeah, Love Inc. is a really, really, really good group. I've interacted with them up in Knoxville, Tennessee, and the Compassion Coalition up there. There's a lot of stuff that group, I think they vary place to place, but I think a lot of things that they're trying to be about is really, really good stuff.
It's been neat, Steve, how you've done some shout-outs for some of the organizations that for years have been incarnating some of the principles that you're talking about, but that I think that's affirming for those ministries and encouraging for others of us to hear that some of this is in action and it's already bearing good fruit, and we can learn from that and continue to grow.
Yeah, Rick, this goes back to, this is not new. This book is not like a new paradigm that we invented and revealed, you know. People have known this forever, and people have practiced it to different degrees, and I think there's becoming an increasing conversation about the importance of these ideas and practicing them, but, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that there's great organizations doing this stuff and have been for a long time. Didn't need the book to help with that.
Good. Well said, and I know in the chat on the side, a couple of folks have mentioned CCDA, the Community Development Association.
Right, great folks.
And they're just doing some very exciting things and have been for a bunch of years and continue.
If you've never been to a CCDA conference, you need to go. It's like the tribe has gathered, and it is just incredibly fun group of people. John Perkins going to his devotions morning. You know, John's the founder of this whole thing. He's in his late 80s, and just listen to the wisdom of that brother. It's worth going just for that. Great group of people. There is this thing called the National Association of Christian Social Workers. They're a little sketchy, but, you know, you might consider, sorry, brother, hanging out with them. No, I really enjoy you guys, and I've had the pleasure of interacting with a few folks out at Diana and others out at the Baylor School of Social Work, and just seeing their increasing talk about community-based social work, and, I mean, that's this the looking at that, which is my kind of background, the community-based model, is really fun.
And I mentioned to you, Steve, there's a new member interest group within NACSW that is looking in a much more intentional way at different poverty alleviation strategies at, you know, local, domestic, and global levels. And so much information that you presented here is part of that discussion. So I think we're going to continue to grow together in some of these directions, and that's pretty exciting.
I saw one question about tokenism from that Caitlin, I think, Duran up in Pittsburgh. Can you expand or restate the main ideas of tokenism? It's basic idea of, okay, here's an example. You're going to run a financial literacy program, money management program. It costs you $50 per person to run through there for the training materials, the how to pay the trainer, the site. I mean, you break it all out, it's $50 per person. And then, so you ask people who are going to be in the program to pay for it. And I'm a big believer in the old adage, if it's free, that's what it's worth. Except for the grace of God, if it's free, you're not actually really to consider, do I really want it or not? And again, as an aside, I'd rather have 10 people that I'm training and working with who really want to be there than 20 people in the room, and 10 of them are just there, but it's free. Or maybe they're because there's a refreshment, so it's not even free to get something. Anyhow, so it costs you $50, and you sit down at price of, let's say, the person has to be $5 for it. $5 in the American context is nothing, right? It's so low that it's almost insulting. And so, you know, charge the $20 or the $25. Again, you might have to have people, you know, be able to pay so much per month if that's not possible. There might be some people that come through, they really can't do that. So you have exceptions, but you set it at a meaningful price that they've got to consider, hey, I've got some skin in the game here. There's an old saying in communalizing, you can tell whether it's going to be successful by the amount of handprints on the action being perceived or considered. And so, they're expecting me to actually really fully participate here in a meaningful way. And so tokenism would be saying, you know, pay $2 or pay $5 when it's realistic for that context to charge $20 or $25, whatever it might be. And that's what tokenism is.
Steve, you've probably seen a bunch more questions coming up. Maybe we'll have to ask you to pick one and go with it, just to be respectful of the folks who only have 75 minutes to be part of this session. So maybe
gotcha.
take a look at the chat and pick the one that you think you can.
Okay, Catherine Reed, okay, my answer to your question is 2.5 hours, so I can't tackle that one. I would tell you, though, here's a book you want to read. I'm sorry about all these books. Former grad of Covenant College, he's a freshman, a senior. Heard John Perkins. He's from Baltimore. A bunch of his buddies from Baltimore, all graduates in the suburbs, realized they were called to go to the inner city of Baltimore, a place called Sandtown. They went there just, actually they said to, John Perkins always talked about the three R's of community development are reconciliation, relocation, racial reconciliation, relocation, you got to be there, part of the community, and then redistribution, which he now talks about in terms of economic development. But these guys added a fourth R, repentance. They realized that they had been benefited as suburban kids from the system that was in place in Baltimore that worked for those white kids and didn't for the African Americans down in the inner city. They moved there not to fix things, just to be good neighbors. They had no agenda. They didn't listen. They didn't even do asset mapping. They just went there to be neighbors. Their book is called To Live in Peace. It is powerful. And over time, they ended up with a health clinic, a school, a this, a that. They planted a church, all these different things. But the way they went about it was all incredibly driven by people from the community versus them as the outsiders coming to do something for the community. Very, very powerful, you know, book is what it means to go new into a community. And the other thing is they were part of it. They went to live there. That was their community too. So they have a right to have a voice because they ended up raising their own kids there. And so they were fellow community members. But you know, that's an inspirational and very intense book. And all this stuff about asset-based, the same as strength-based. I see all that. I don't see anything else. Anybody? I'm going to ask a question from, do you want to open up the mics at all?
We'll have time for one more if anyone wants to hit *6 on their telephone pad and ask Steve a question that he can answer in 1 minute. Let's go. Hit *6 on your phone pad and again, pose a question or make a comment to Steve. It'll be the last word.
And Catherine, I'm just looking at you. Thank you. What were the authors of To Live in Peace? Mark Gornick is the author. Mark Gornick.
Hey, Steve.
Yes.
You're awesome.
I'll get you your $50 later.
I really appreciated the truth in your the class you taught. And the other thing is have you ever heard of Helping Hands in the Philippines?
Yes.
It's an LDS program.
Absolutely. My co-professor here has worked in the Philippines. His wife's Filipina. Yeah, very familiar with them. Or familiar enough with them, I should say, right?
Yeah, so that's all it is. I just want to see if you had heard of that. So, and I appreciate your presentation,
yep.
Steve. All right.
Thanks, man.
Have a blessed day. Bye.
You too, brother.
Well, let me take this opportunity to thank everyone today for your participation. Lots of cool comments coming in through the chat, the content that you added to the session. A lot of setting up for Steve for going in some directions that he might not have gone otherwise. So thank you for that participation. And, Steve, thank you for today's excellent session. That I hope we continue to have these discussions between you and the work you're doing with Chalmers Center and NACSW. There's a lot more that we to learn from you. And I think there are a lot of stories of NACSW members who are doing the work
right.
that you describe in your book that you would be encouraged by. Interdisciplinary dialogue, I think it's just good for all of us. So we hope to continue this discussion.
Absolutely. For any of you still on, if you have stories and examples, I love to hear those. You know, I turn them into blog posts or they can show up in books. But my address is Corbett, my last name, at covenant.edu. It's at Covenant College, at corbett.covenant.edu. I love to hear examples. I can pass them on to others. If nothing else, I can use them in my classes. I promise I won't claim them as my own. But that's just helpful for all of us to grow and learn from each other.
Steve, I'm sorry that we're not hearing you at this point.
Oh, I stopped talking for a minute there. So
okay,
now you're really quiet. I said my piece about sending me stuff, and then it was like quiet. Like, oh, I didn't get anything.
For those of you who are interested in obtaining documentation of CEUs for today, simply go to the NACSW webpage where you originally registered, click on the follow-up CEU link, and that will get you in the direction that you need to be to complete your CEUs. And I'll also be sending out in the next 15 minutes a direct link to this page so that you can collect your CEUs that way. Also, for those of you who might be interested, NACSW has recently organized, as I mentioned, a poverty alleviation member interest group. For more information about this member interest group, I'll send you a link to the webpage that we're using to collect information, or you can contact me directly at nacsw.org. And then lastly, I'd like to invite you to consider signing up for our next audio conference webinar. It's scheduled for Monday, April 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The topic in April is going to be Leadership in Times of Crisis, Christ's Call to Competent Compassion Medical Health Services, facilitated by Bob Vanderpoel, an Employee Assistance and Church Assistance Program Manager. Thank you so much for your participation today in our webinar. Please don't hesitate to contact us if any questions or comments related to today's session. Steve, again, thank you so much for being here with us, and we look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.